Brewers Publications is pleased to present their newest title from Stan Hieronymus, Brewing Local, American-Grown Beer. Written for homebrewers with a sense of adventure, Brewing Local is all about using cultivated and foraged ingredients in your beer. For those who are ready to go beyond pumpkin beer and start making beer with lesser-known ingredients like pawpaws and cow parsnip, Brewing Local is a must-have guide. Learn more at brewerspublications.com. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 22nd, 2016. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, the last of our whirlwind tour of the Baltimore, D.C. area with a visit to Blue Jacket and the Arsenal and head brewer Josh Chapman. Mike Tonsmeyer calls Blue Jacket the Disney World of beer. We'll tour the facility and learn why. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener. Don't forget to get a copy of our Brewer's Logbook. You can use it to log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We also have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first. Go to basicbrewing.com, click on our Amazon ad. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes, our Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, and we're on the Stitcher app as well. We're on Google Play Music, and we're on the iHeartRadio app, too. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who's done so already. If you follow us on Twitter and Facebook, you know that there has been big news in the Northwest Arkansas homebrew world. Steve Wilkes is taking over the home brewery in Fayetteville and will eventually rename it Steve's Brew Shop. Andy Sparks, who has run the home brewery for 21 years and has arguably transformed the homebrew and brewing world in our area, Andy has been looking to move in another direction for some time. Along with his more than full-time job as a software developer, he has a pizza catering business where he'll bring a pizza oven to your event and make custom delicious pizzas in no time, right on the spot. So he wants to concentrate more on that and build that business like he's built the home brewery. And Steve is retired from the University of Arkansas, and so it's a great time for the switch to take place. Great timing. You'll hear more as the transformation occurs, but I just want to get that out there. I'm very excited for both Steve and Andy in the next phases of their business lives. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Holger Michaelis writes, after hearing my conversation with Chris Colby on tannins, you may remember that we met Holger at back when it was called NHC in San Diego a couple of years ago. Holger says, I enjoyed your recent interview with Chris Colby on tannins in beer. It was good to feel vindicated in squeezing the grain bag. I've always squeezed the grain bag for both for grains plus extract and brew in a bag and never had problems. Holger says, unless I missed it, I heard no mention of techniques to remove tannins from beer, and I wanted to relate my experience using PVPP, that's polyvinyl PVPP. Holger says it's a Reinheitsgebot. I can't even pronounce Reinheitsgebot, approved polymer that binds to tannins and removes them from beer and wine. It settles to the bottom of the fermenter and is left behind when racking off the sediment. Holger says, I've used PVPP to tame the tannins from excessive amounts of hops used in a couple of Imperial IPAs with great success. The commercial product sold in most homebrew shops is called Polyclar VT. Well, thanks, Holger. That's good information. By the way, I told Holger that I probably was going to not be able to pronounce the long word for PVPP, but, you know, there you go. By the way, Chris Colby's Homebrew Recipe Bible is officially out now and is apparently doing well on Amazon. And the low price that they had on it for the pre-release is apparently staying. So be sure to check that out. Chris Colby's Homebrew Recipe Bible. My Frankenberry Vice is one of the more than 100 recipes, and it's a beautiful book as well. Very well done by the publisher. In other news, I racked my current low-gravity 100% rye kettle-soured beer out of primary yesterday with the help from my wife, Susan. We bottled a few bottles plain, and then we put sour cherries in one Mr. Beer fermenter and peach and mango chunks in another to rack the beer on top of. And it'll sit there for about a week before bottling. We tasted the beer, and it's moderately tart with a lot of grapefruit character from the hops. So I'm hoping that the fruit will pair well with those flavors. I mentioned on the show that I used a couple of those Good Belly mango shots as the lactose source, and it's not as tart as I was expecting, as I said. And I got an email from Chuck. Don't know where Chuck's from. Chuck says, I've been brewing sours for a while now. I also use the Good Belly mango shots. You have to use lactic acid to reduce your pH to 4.3 to keep the nasties out. Then I add the Good Belly at 110 degrees Fahrenheit and let it free fall to room temperature wrapped in blankets. After 48 hours, it gets down to 3.4 to 3.0 pH. Thanks, Chuck. I appreciate that. I pasteurized mine to keep the nasties out before putting the Good Belly mango shots in there. So I'm hoping that that will do the trick. I'm going to keep playing with kettle souring. I really like the idea of a tart session beer based on rye with a low ABV and lots of flavor. So stay tuned. This comes in from Mark in Long Island, New York. Mark says, I'm eagerly awaiting the delivery of my 15-gallon high-gravity electric brew system. I hope to use it for the first time this weekend. My question for you is, what efficiency and losses do you use when formulating your recipes for the system? Well, I appreciate that, Mark. As you know, Desiree and Dave of High Gravity are sponsors of this podcast, and they gave Steve and me electric Brunabag systems to use. I don't pay as close attention to calculating efficiency as I used to when I first got into all-grain brewing, especially with these weird rye beers I've been I've been playing with. However, I went back into my brewer's logbook and picked out a couple of moderate gravity, more traditional brews to benchmark with calculations. One weighed in at 77% efficiency. The other reached 82% efficiency. So I'm pretty happy with that for sure. I found that milling with a narrow gap, because you don't have to worry about a stuck sparge in brewing a bag, and stirring the mash every 10 or 15 minutes has really helped my efficiency. And you can take refractometer readings to see how you're progressing during the mash, if you like. I've also found on occasion that resting past the 60-minute mark has been marginally beneficial. So mill aggressively, stir often, relax, don't worry, etc. And those apply for brewing a bag no matter what setup you have. But congratulations on the new system, Mark. I know that you'll like it. Steve and I went over to Tulsa this past weekend to help celebrate the 12th anniversary of the High Gravity Shop. When we walked in, Dave was back in the workshop putting together systems. Just, you know, shoulder deep in work. apparently, a bunch of y'all took advantage of the anniversary discounts, and we'll be getting new High Gravity systems. We got to meet some folks at the shop, and then Steve and I ate a ton of great barbecue at Burnco that evening at the party, as well as we sampled some very tasty homebrew that Desiree had on tap. Somebody brought a strawberry mead that was especially tasty as well. I want to congratulate again Desiree and Dave on 12 years of business, and I want to thank them for the hospitality this past weekend, and especially thank them for the ongoing support of this podcast. And thanks to those of you who are supporting High Gravity as they support us. So it's all one circle, one great circle. Check out all the great gear and kits at High Gravity's awesome website, highgravitybrew.com. Well, this is the last interview from our trip to the Baltimore, D.C. area in conjunction with HomebrewCon. It's been a while since I've listened to this one, and I really enjoyed hearing it again. Josh Chapman and Blue Jacket are doing some really fun and creative things, including techniques like open fermentation, inoculating with a cool ship, kettle souring, and more traditional stuff, too. As Mike Tonsmeyer says, it's the Disney World of brewpubs. Mike Tonsmeyer, where are we at now?
We are in the back, I guess, the keg cleaning area of Blue Jacket / the Arsenal.
And who do we have here?
This is Josh Chapman, who is the head brewer, is your title? Excellent. And you've been here since the beginning, right?
Yeah. Been here since late June of 2013, so a few months. We opened October 29th, 2013, so was here when we still had a mash tun hanging from the crane in the middle of the room, and everybody would walk around it because nobody wanted to be the guy that had a drop on them, basically. So
what makes Blue Jacket special? Why are we here? Maybe, who should I ask? Should I ask Tonsmeyer or should I ask you?
So one of the things that I think at the heart and soul of Blue Jacket makes it unique is with as many breweries as are opening, most of them are opening up either with one specific beer kind of niche that they're going for, or they're trying to do some standard things and get some production out of them and get their names out there. Because of the restaurant group that we're a part of, Neighborhood Restaurant Group, who owns and operates an incredible beer bar called Churchkey in D.C., Greg Engert, who's our beer director, huge beer connoisseur and a craft beer champion. When we opened Blue Jacket, the goal wasn't to be any other brew pub. It was to immediately start with as much experimentation and boundary pushing as we could be. So most, I feel like most breweries that would open up these days, and even when we opened up 3 years ago, you'd open with your pilot batch tested, tried and true set of five flagship beers that you know you could get into market, you know you could rally support behind. We started with the express goal and the stated goal of never doing the same beer twice. That eventually went by the wayside, fortunately, because 20 beers never being the same is a bit of a large task. But as you see when we'll walk the brewery, we don't have four 60-barrel fermenters for our 15-barrel system. We have 16 15-barrel fermenters for our 15-barrel systems, just so we can play around. So it's a lot of space. It's a lot of creative space and creative freedom. With that, there's a lot of hits. There are also misses. But for us, the misses are just as important as the hits because they teach us and our consumer base about what beer can be and where it can go and what works and doesn't work. So, yeah.
Excellent. We've all got different beers, I think. So eventually, we'll maybe want to talk about them and talk about the different directions and things like that. But lead on.
Perfect.
Macduff, is that the quote?
So we're in the, as Mike was saying, we're in the multi-purpose room that is keg washing, the mill and grain room and keg storage, also vintage jockey box storage, stickers, boots, small woodland creatures.
We used to have when I was growing up, we had a green Coleman just like that. It's amazing.
Just like everything else, that green Coleman that was probably like $10, you know, when it was made. Now, if you can find it, it's like $120. Because
I was actually going to ask if those were purchased new, or this is like, you know, someone has been going to flea markets and buying older looking.
Those are actually found, like garage sailed and in people's, you know. So we started to look for them again because we realized they were really cool, yeah, and they were a lot of money. So we gave up on it.
I pinched my fingers in that latch many a time.
Right? They were not the most user-friendly, but they sure do look cool. They're also, I feel like, three times as heavy as modern day coolers are. Those are this. So this entire facility, I think, is about 75,000 square feet. The entire length of the building. It was part of the Navy Yard complex during World War II. Was a steam boiler factory. When we go up to the pitch of the roof, you'll see the crane that actually ran the boilers back and forth on the railroad ties. So really cool building with a lot of history. One of the things that that brings with it are some historical aesthetics built into our lease. So you see a bunch of malt behind you. We'll get a malt order in today. We usually get two malt orders in a week because we can't have a silo because of the historical aesthetics of the lease. So there's always pros and cons with everything. The con is that we have to hand unload every bag because there's no... The loading dock is at the opposite end of the building, and you can't actually fit a grain cart between there all the way back here or a pallet truck. So that's a lot of fun. But we'll typically get 2 to 3 tons of grain in a week. Everything gets milled here in the lowest space of the building. Goes through a vertical auger upstairs to a junction box. Goes into a flexible auger. Goes to the pitch of the roof where we brew. And then once we're all done brewing, it makes its way slowly back down here to finish its life and be served. So.
Nice.
This is our Christopher Walken, our Walking Phoenix, our Walking Dead. We're scouring for more Walken, you know, really terrible puns. We just haven't found any.
Come into the Walken cooler. We're walking and talking in the Walken cooler.
Oh, walkie-talkie. There's one. Ah, see? This is why, what is it? Six heads is better than one. So this is our cold storage. For absolutely everything, as you can see, not just for the beer. Front of house has all their wines in here. Hops live in here. Yeast, both in Brinks and other ways, is in here. We've got about, I don't know, 150 on the stove. We got about another 600 pounds of strawberries in here right now that just came in yesterday that are amazing from us.
Smells great.
They're so good, man. There's a lot of quality control that's going on with these strawberries right now. So the really unique thing about this room, same thing that they've done at Churchkey. You can hear those pumps clicking off behind you, yanking on those serving lines and keg lines. We have it set up like that because these two silver boxes back here, and there are two more behind the fluorescent light over there, they're basically heat exchangers. So we have a system set up here that we can serve our beers in three different temperature zones. We have five beers at 42, 10 in that Goldilocks range at 48, and then five at 54. And it's a really neat system. It's like $40,000 worth of equipment on one wall.
Yeah.
So another one of those fun things that being a part of a restaurant group, you know, helps us be able to do things that, you know, another brew pub wouldn't probably be able to start with, but allows us to jump around a lot of things. I remember we had a double on one time, we had it on at 48 and it just didn't, it was super muted, put it on at 54. It was a completely different beer. So it's a fun thing, when it works, to actually go.
I gotta ask you, what you're going to do with the strawberries?
So the strawberries are actually going into one beer that we've done before that we'll continue to do seasonally. It's called The Jam. It's a strawberry and rhubarb Berliner Weiss, which is a beer I initially made because my wife loves strawberry rhubarb. And if I'm going to spend as much time here as I am, we better make something that she likes.
That's a good rule for homebrewers as well.
Always, right? Always be incorporating. Otherwise, you're going to be isolated very quickly. So, and then we have another Cloudwater Brewing out of Manchester, England, was here. We did a collaboration with him. We did a grisette-style beer that we hit on the back end with some Brett C and we're hitting with a bunch of fresh strawberries as well. So that'll be fun.
So what's the key of working with the strawberries?
You know, they're... Everybody kind of has their own tricks to how they use fruit. I've messed with them a lot, and they have a high water content, which can be a bit of a bad thing just because you can end up... We've used them fresh a lot of times just by cutting them up, putting them in some finished beer, and they've diluted the beer a little bit and kind of thinned it out. So what we like to do is put a little bit of water in the bottom of a pot, fill the pot with all the strawberries just so they don't burn with that little layer of water on the bottom, put some heat on them so that they get nice and soft, and then we'll puree them ourselves, basically. I've used strawberry puree from Oregon Fruit Products. It's great. It's just from Oregon, and shipping is a nightmare. And if we can use a really wonderful local product and save on shipping at the same time, we get a win. So, yeah, we'll put some heat on them. Usually I try to bring them right up to 185 degrees just to pasteurize them really quickly. buzz them, and then bring them in, cool them down, and get them in the beer as quickly as possible. So,
nice.
Right.
What are you drinking, Steve?
I'm drinking a, is it pronounced Goes or Goza? Does anybody know? How do you pronounce it? G-O-S-E, Goza. That's very good.
Goza.
I would say Goza, but I wasn't sure. Yeah,
Goza. Sorry. Because every time we say Goza, somebody's like, oh, is that the one where you blend it? And I'm like, no. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to walk upstairs now. So basically we're following the grain now. We've milled it, and we're going to walk all the way up to the pitch of the building.
And I've got the Kolsch, dry hopped Kolsch, which is also very delicious. It's rough work here. We're in this job where we're walking up the stairs. We're overlooking the dining room, which has got a modern feel to it. Amongst the fermenters, we saw some barrels in the distance there. We're still walking upstairs. Anybody need a break from walking? Hey.
Oof.
Here at the top of the world.
Pretty much. We have thin brewers at Blue Jacket.
if you're hauling your own grain and walking those stairs.
Oh, yeah. It's a Stairmaster every single day. So a lot of water consumed. And, you know, you burn off a lot of those beer carbohydrates pretty quickly. So. It's a win. You can feel the temperature change when you get up here, though, because there's no attic fan. So it gets a little steamy. We peaked at 123 degrees last year in late July.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, mid-brew and everything. We were graining out. Yeah, it was like 80% humidity. And
sounds like my old apartment.
D.C., right? They always like to say it's a swamp. So we followed the grain from the very bottom floor to the very top. It actually goes into the highest vessel in the brewery, which is our grist case. This guy's sitting right on top of our mash tun. We've got a three-vessel premier brewing system, a direct-fired mash tun, a separate louder tun, and then we've got the boil kettle across from that. So it'll hang out up there until ready to brew. We've got the little hydration arm coming in the side, so as soon as we start mashing in, obviously, we mix all that water with the grain so it doesn't get stodgy and get a bunch of dough balls in the bottom of the kettle. Works pretty well for us. We've been able to figure out ways to do different things. We have direct fire because we did want to be able to do step mashes. We wanted to be able to potentially decoct. We have to do it in a kind of a reverse order because of the way our system's set up. But we've been able to do some fun things with it. It's worked pretty well for us. A lot of people will say that this brewery is gravity fed, which is somewhat true. It's not completely true. You can't get through a heat exchanger with just gravity. So we'll use CO2 pressure mostly to help, but once we get things started, gravity typically takes over. We get a good draw, and things kind of flow on their own. So yeah, you can see, though, if you come over here, this is the old steam boiler crane, and I mean, the ties are still there. It was actually in our space when we were still building out and doing construction, but the architects didn't feel comfortable leaving it here with all of the other equipment we were putting in. So this old guy jumps in curmudgeonly, fires it up, rolls it back, grabs a $500 check and leaves. And I was like, okay, this is a trade that I should learn.
Yeah.
Pays pretty well. So yeah, pretty neat facility. I feel like Idea Space is leasing this upper floor to Ideate or something. Apparently ideating pays well.
Under a large crane?
Yes, under a large crane. So, boil kettle, obviously where we'll do all of our, not all of our, but most of our hop additions, any spice additions. It is a combo. We've got a tangential arm on the side, so we'll whirlpool in this vessel because we can use the pump to kick back in there, create the vortex, and everything will deposit in the center so that we can leave it as we run off through the Hedex. We've got hard piping on the kind of the sides of all of our cellars, and then we'll use brewer's hosing to navigate between tanks and everywhere else. The only thing that we won't put through the hard piping are our wild beers. We have extra brewer's hosing, so we can just go through a specific wild set of hosing to get stuff places. So, yeah.
Well, let's pick a couple of beers to talk about. Let's talk about my Kolsch here.
So that Kolsch Forbidden Planet is the only beer we've actually had on every single day since we opened. We are, you can actually see, if you lean over, you can see Nationals Ballpark from this brew house. So being as close as we are to a baseball stadium, we get a beer hungry, but sometimes beer uneducated group of people that come in often. And we knew that we weren't going to have Bud Light on tap as well, right? It's not the purpose of this place. So we wanted to find some ways to help educate the clientele that were coming in. Kolsch is a great style. It's crisp, it's clean, it's always drinkable. There's really never a bad time for it. But it's also a really great canvas for showcasing something that somebody might not be accustomed to, right? So I would have to say the number one thing that we've gotten since we opened is, and pretty much everywhere, I don't like hoppy beer, right? That's the first big thing that somebody that's new to craft beer will say. And it's one of those things that doesn't actually mean anything until they can put their own meaning to it. So for us, we said, let's take a Kolsch, dry, crisp, very, very baseball beer, right? And let's dry hop it with something unique. So that we can showcase and help people understand what they're tasting, why they're tasting what they're tasting, and what it is that they actually do and do not prefer. That's not to say that some people won't have this Galaxy Dry Hop Kolsch and say, I don't like this, it's too hoppy. And we go, okay, you're just not a big fan of really fruity, you know, light, crisp beers. That's fine. People are going to do that. But for the most part, it's been a very good tool for us to kind of show people what hops can and cannot be, and what their palates actually are. So,
I have that desire. Anytime someone tells me, "Oh, I don't like mustard or something," I have this desire to make the, maybe you like it if it was on a leg of lamb and roasted and smoked and that's sort of that, exactly that. That, you know, hey, maybe you mean I don't like bitterness and not I don't like hops.
Yeah, it's not an overly bitter beer.
No.
But I think it fits well in that Kolsch, you know, character. Do you find that the Kolsch yeast plays well with dry hopping?
Yeah, I do. It's funny. I think like most brewers have started using Chico for a lot of things, and it's a great yeast, and I still use it on some things because it'll just chug. We have an Imperial Stout that fermented itself well over 12% ABV. Just with a big, healthy pitch of Chico. Not a San Diego Super, nothing crazy, you know. So I like it. But one of the things that I've found here, especially with beers that we like to do some extra hopping or fruit or something with, is using a yeast that's got maybe a little more backbone to it. It doesn't even have to be necessarily phenolic or estery, but something that has some depth and complexity to it, whether that's a little like earthiness or a little background, you know, extra, maybe it'll push the breadiness a little more or something. But I've been finding that we've shied away from those super clean yeasts because honestly at the end of the day I want it to taste like beer, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't want it to be paint by numbers. And I think sometimes we can do that, we overthink it and we want some things to shine, but just like humanity, we're all better in relationship, and I think a little bit of everybody playing together always makes a better end product. So we like the Kolsch yeast a lot. Again, that's why we didn't just do, even with the Pilsner yeast, as we've done really hoppy Pilsners, I've still found us going towards higher aromatic profile lager yeast strains or things that'll push the breadiness of the Pilsner malt more, because it just creates a more well-rounded, deeper product at the end. So,
and then you've got Steve's Goza. What do you think of that?
I love it. It's a, you know, got that nice little salt thing going, and it's a little bit bready. It's just very refreshing, and it's a nice beer to drink.
So this was Ricky, who's our brewer, loves botanicals. It's the thing that he always comes and tugs on my shirt the most. He's like, when are we going to do a chrysanthemum beer? When are we going to do a honeysuckle beer? Okay, calm down, Ricky. We'll get to it. But one of the things that I've fallen in love with here is light kettle sours, Berliner Weisses, Goza style kettle sours. I think my background's culinary, and one of the things that obviously now more and more breweries are becoming more comfortable with, but acidity is just one of those normal everyday flavors that we love. And for some reason, we've been afraid of it in the brewing world. And I think it's just another tool in the toolbox to highlight things and to showcase things. So this Goza, we do a Goza base that will kind of tweak the salt and coriander on depending on what we're doing with it. But pretty standard Pilsner wheat. And that's an Antwerp ale yeast, which has a little bit of, again, just a little background earth and spice to round it out. And then we get to play with a lot of different things with it. This one is chrysanthemum. It was like only 5 pounds of dried chrysanthemum flowers, and botanicals pack a punch, especially when dried. So
you get the flowers in that?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's. I don't want to have it suggested, but... But yeah, it's kind of flowery and spicy, and it's just a terrific beer. If we have lunch, I'll probably have a full one of these.
Oh. Yeah. That's a good compliment.
Yeah. I'll take it.
Where's the next stop?
Next stop, we'll head down to our cellars, so we can take a look at the fermenters and just kind of where the beer goes.
Again, point the mic at who's talking, James. We're going downhill this time, down the stairs. Got a nice crowd. They're all looking at the guy with the microphone and the headphones. The cellar is not in the cellar.
No. Yeah, our cellars are hanging in midair. So this is cellar two. We have two different cellars. Cellar two is just below the brew house. We've got 18 fermenters at Blue Jacket. 16 of them are 15-barrel fermenters, which is the same size as our system, which, again, allows us to play and do a lot of different things. We have 2 30-barrel fermenters, so if there's something we want to do a double batch of, there's definitely beers that have grown a good following, and we'll do our big shocker, our all Citra English ale-based IPA people enjoy. So we usually brew doubles of that and some other things. Yeah, so it's interesting learning systems. I was just talking about this with somebody else, talking about taking recipes and, could you just take your recipe and go brew it somewhere else and be exactly the same? And it's just never going to be exactly the same. And I think that's the best part of beer. Yeast is a living organism, and it behaves differently in different environments and under different pressures, just like I do, just like you do. Even in this brewery, we've found that we have to play that game, because on this level, when they built this level, we had to build it a little shorter than the cellar downstairs is. So these fermenters have to be shorter and squattier. So that means we get an entirely different environment for the same yeast up here as we would downstairs. And we found, especially with our Belgian and more estery and phenolic yeast, that brewing them downstairs allows them to be more expressive, and brewing them up here mutes them a little bit. Just because of the size and shape of the exact same volume fermenter, but the fact that these are short and squatty, it has a smaller area for that convected motion as it's fermenting around. It has a shorter kind of headspace area, so just produces differently. It also doesn't crop very well, but that's a whole other issue. So.
Honestly, I think that's something that homebrewers are often missing, because we just do one thing, then we move on to something else. We buy one yeast strain, use it for 3 batches, and then something else. I think the big advantage that professional brewers have is that experience, that repetition with slight variations. When I was out at Modern Times last time, they'd just gotten some new 300-barrel fermenters up from the 200 where, and they were saying how much better they thought the hoppy beers were in those big fermenters, because the cone is the better angle, and yada, yada, yada. And as a home brewer, it's like, well, there's nothing I can do to you know, replicate that or even consider that.
Yeah, different shape fermenters when you're at 5 or 10 gallons is not going to be nearly the impact of even these, which are small, relatively commercial fermenters.
Definitely. And we had Yvonne Betts from Brasserie de la Seine about a month ago. We were doing a collaboration with him, and every time I talk to him, I still ask him, I'm like, square fermenters, really? Like, talk to me about these square fermenters. And it's funny, because if you talk to him, the thing that he's most passionate about is how he takes care of his yeast. Because if he takes care of his yeast, he can fix everything else. But you can't fix yeast. Like, it is what it is, and how you treat it and how you raise it is how your beer is going to develop. And he said, I've found that this works in this fermenter, so I want to keep it this way as much as humanly possible. Everything else I can fix. So,
wow. Let's talk about another beer. What'd you get, Mike?
I got the chair or something?
Oh, broken chairs.
Broken yes. chairs. Porter, nice roasty character. Definitely a little bit more bitter than I think a lot of Americans do their porters, which I really appreciate. I think so many people have those English beers once they come over here and they sit on the shelf for 6 months. And it's the same thing with the Belgian beers. You end up brewing to what something tastes like when it's already aged. And this is a lot more brighter, fresher, more vibrant. I mean, we'll take a look at the open fermenter that this was in shortly. But again, a place like this that has those tools and that variety to be able to put different beers and treat them in different ways so you don't end up with everything sort of tasting the same. You go to some breweries and they have the same house yeast that gets used on almost everything, the same fermenters, the same base malt, the same. And sure, they're different colors, and sure, they're going to have a little bit more this or a little bit more that, but they're all kind of in a small box. And you come here and you really know that all the beers have this wide variety. It really is like going to a beer bar, but everything's made here.
Now it's an interesting point. Because of architectural considerations, you can't have silos, right. But that opens you up to maybe a more diverse variety of malts.
Yeah, we're never going to allow ourselves to be complacent. I think content is okay in some fashions, and there are going to be parts of beers that we are content with, but I think there are no perfect beers. It wouldn't be any fun if there were anyway, really, right? Where's the joy in that? We'll have beers that we keep the name the same on, but we'll change, like Scarecrow that I just finished. We started with, I think, the Thierrier yeast strain and...
French Saison,
exactly. And that was it. And then we used Blaugie, which, again, I can never remember.
Farmhouse.
Yeah. And we put in a little Brett Brux, and this one was the DuPont with Brett Lambicus, and we've called it Scarecrow the entire time.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is we knew starting this that we were able to communicate that with the people that were coming here. We're always going to be experimenting. You might not see the same beer twice, and if you see it again, it might be 6 months later, and that'll be the first time we'll have brewed it, and we're going to do something a little different. The ethos for that beer will be the same, but it may taste a little different, be nuanced differently.
And I certainly could be wrong, but Mexican Radio, I think, probably started out as a slightly smaller beer than it is now. I saw it at 7.4, which is more what I think of when I think of chili, chocolate, cinnamon. And I think I remember it was mid to high fives, maybe, when you guys opened.
Yeah, it was, and again, that's, sometimes it feels like cheating, right? Because the brewers that I am consistently blown away by are the ones that do make the same beer. And it tastes so stinking perfect every single time you have it. It blows my mind how they're able to pull that off consistently. But it's also a different goal and a different mindset. When we started Mexican Radio, our thought was, we'll do a slightly smaller milk stout, and then we'll do all these different things to it. We wanted to do something that was a little more, I hate the word sessionable, but a little lower in ABV. But then as we did it, we just realized the sum of the parts wasn't greater than the whole,
yeah.
Right? And it's nice to be in a place where we can let the beer tell us what it needs to be and wants to be, and then we can adapt and adjust that way.
And it's not like you guys have 16 beers on and they're all 8, 9, 10% alcohol. You have plenty of other things that are sessionable. And so not everything has to be sessionable.
No, definitely not. And it is nice to be able to come. Like, I can't remember the last time I sat down and said, I'm going to go, you know, crush a couple of Bourbon County Stout now, right?
If you could get your hands on them.
Exactly. I could actually find one. So it's nice to be able to have some of those beers. Like, we have a sherry barrel-aged barley wine on downstairs that I think is like 12-ish. And it's nice to every now and then be able to have a little sip of that and then immediately fall asleep.
And honestly, particularly as a brew pub where I assume a lot of your sales are the taster, the 4-ounce pours, yeah. And that, to me, is the way I want to drink a lot of those beers. I don't want to get the bomber of the 12% beer and then have to find someone to split with and then dump out half of it. Come here, have a great dinner, have a few full pours of the Kolsch or the Goza, and then, hey, for dessert, why not 4 ounces of something big and sweet and interesting and complex and all those great things.
And speaking of big and sweet, what did you get, Bob?
I got the farmhouse, Hoppy Farmhouse.
Oh, Delta.
Yeah, the Anacostia Delta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very, very good. very good. In fact, mine was gone before he got done handing out the glasses. I got a whiff of the hops, and I went crazy. It was very good. Thank you.
I had the same thing as Bob. It had Citra and Mosaic. Delicious little farmhouse, dry-hopped farmhouse ale.
That may be what I have for lunch.
similar in concept to Forbidden Planet. Again, a really fun educational beer, but we take something that people might be scared off by, a peppery, spicy yeast, but, you know, dry hop with Citro Mosaic, and it's the same thing. Like, you get the guys that we've all had our progressions in beer, right? Because, you start to like craft beer, and the first thing you go to is, like, super intense hop flavor, I feel like.
Oh, yeah.
And then the curve goes.
Opposite.
Exactly.
It's everything that Budweiser isn't.
Exactly. And then I feel like people start to go into, like, that farmhouse Belgian or the big stouts or something weird stuff. Yeah. So it's a good educational beer for us as well.
I'm curious about the level of training that you have to provide to the wait staff, to the bartenders, because as beers evolve and change subtly, you can't just have somebody walk up and say, well, we have all of them. And so, you know, speak to that just a little bit, because if you're in the business, how do you address that? How do you deal with that?
We have a rigorous training program, really within all the NRG properties, which is a tribute to Greg and his passion and his unyieldedness when it comes to people and their beer knowledge. But we've got, I was just looking at yesterday, I don't know, 56 pages of just how we like to break beers down. We break them down in a couple of categories here. We've got malt and roast. We've got, hoppy. We've got tart and funky. We've got all these different things, ways that we're able to break them down. But our servers start, when they first come here for training, their very first task is to get a tour of the brewery and to walk the brewing process. And that's the foundation that we build them off for their service. It's not, how do you carry a tray? It's not, what are the table numbers? It's, this is brewing, this is how we do it, and then we start unpacking what those ingredients look like, what the processes look like, and we do a lot of tasting. Every pre-shift, there's going to be something that's tasted. One of the brew staff will be there, and one of the managers will be there. Mm-hmm. We'll do a team tasting, see what everybody gets, talk about the style, the yeast, whatever it is. There's lots of quizzes, and we're continually refreshing those quizzes and giving them out to everybody. So it's a group effort for sure.
Yeah, I think you'd have to have a lot of buy-in from everybody. And one of the things that aggravates me as a customer when I go to a nice restaurant that even has a good beer list is that the wait staff cannot describe it to you. They cannot tell you something about what they're serving. And so it's good to hear what an organization that really takes that seriously does and how they address it. And so I appreciate that.
No, it's honestly... We're very fortunate because of the name that we have and we've grown, the people that come here, it's the anomaly, the person that comes in and doesn't understand craft beer and, doesn't really have an affinity for it. So we're very fortunate in that, but it's a great way to, everybody wants to feel like they're a part of something.
Yeah.
And for the servers, we do the best job that we can as brewers to give them things off of fermenters, right, that are in process and that we're excited about, because if we're excited about it in the middle of the process, they're going to be even more excited about it by the time it finally hits a bright tank and they're ready to serve it. Like that Chrysanthemum Goza, we just tapped it for the first time today, and the service staff has been freaking out trying to get it on because they love that beer right now, and they've watched it through the whole process, and they couldn't wait to start being able to tell their customers about it because they're excited about it. So,
wow. I think it's the same reason people love coming to brew pubs and to breweries. Is it feels like something different than going to. I love going to church. Yeah, I love going to a great beer bar, but it's kind of like listening to an album on your headphones, and this is like going to the concert.
Yes,
and even though it may not always be quite as crisp, because it's a live performance, right. You're getting, as you were saying, those hits and those misses. But those hits are so much better because you know that you have been responsible for the whole way. There's no one else to blame. You can't blame the distributor for it sitting somewhere. You can't blame the bar for not cleaning. This is as good as the beer can possibly be.
Yeah, definitely. Totally agree.
How many more stops on the tour?
we'll do two. So over to our right, and I am skipping a barrel area, but we'll do a different barrel area. So that is our non-wild barrel area. We've got all sorts of stuff, mostly bourbon. Those will be our spirit barrels. Those will be the higher alcohol Stouts, barley wines.
We have some... He's not letting me within 30 feet of them.
No. No, no, no. We do need to get some stuff out of there actually soon. I want you to taste. Some cool sherry butts back there that actually we refilled as soon as we pulled the barley one that's downstairs. We immediately refilled with the same recipe.
Sherry Butt was Steve's nickname in high school.
Cold sherry butt.
I like that. I'm going to use that. So that's that. I don't know what more to say. They're barrels. We put beer in them. It tastes really good. We have a couple of unique fermenters here. This is a horizontal fermenter. A lot of times used for lagers and hefeweizens. We actually use it solely for lactobacillus. So this is where, when I say kettle sour, we do it in a bit of a deconstructed way here just because of the amount of tanks we have. So we will brew unhopped wort. The base beer will purge this completely free of oxygen, and we've got our lactobacillus culture waiting in there. We'll send down the wort at around 110 degrees. It's not heated, but it's jacketed like a normal fermenter, so it'll hold temp pretty well. And it usually only takes for our culture about 16 hours to get down to where we want it to be acidity-wise. So we only use that for those sour cultures, which is a lot of fun because we know we've got something. We're able to run back on that culture 4 or 5 times before we have to prop up a new blend. So.
Wow. So that's a fun one.
This is Graham. Graham is bottling all of our 750s that we sell as our kind of loosely termed growlers. It's a very rudimentary system, and it's super labor-intensive. And he's doing it for free because he's amazing. So anytime you have a Blue Jacket beer, just remember Graham standing here working for free on a Wednesday.
Thanks, Graham. He might get a beer or two out of it.
So this is the other really unique fermenter that we have. This is our open fermenter, a very traditional brewing vessel. When we were talking about yeast being a living organism and operating differently in different environments and pressures, this is like hippie yeast, playground, because there is no pressure on this yeast. This is hedge fund baby, fermenter right here, because he knows he is set. So we typically find not only do we get more expressive yeast characteristic, but also different. Sometimes we'll get a lot more fruit from a saison yeast than we have ever gotten out of a conical, or a lot more spice, or something just entirely different that we haven't gotten before just because it's been here. So pretty neat little vessel, and it's you'll be stoked about this. So I'll do it again, I think later today or tomorrow, but we've now fermented fully stainless conical beers with top cropped yeast from this guy, which was a bit of a, it looked healthy, the cell counts looked good, but it still freaked me out. But man, it's cool. It's really, so last weekend, again, going back to our all Citra English Ale IPA, that is probably our most popular beer, we still tweak with. It is the same yeast strain, but I pulled it from an open fermenter as opposed to propping from conical fermenter like that, and it's a little softer, a little more stone fruity than it was before, so pretty cool.
So do you cap that off at some point as the crowds starts to fall, or after you top crop?
So what we'll do is, the nice thing is we've got these SVs right here, so as soon as we see that primary fermentation is starting to slow, we'll drop the lid and we'll transfer it down and let it finish fermentation in one of the bright tanks. Otherwise, it'll oxidize and be really metallic and gross.
We're in another barrel room now. He'll let Tonsmeyer in this one.
You've been in here before.
This is not my first time in here.
This is my favorite room in the brewery, not surprisingly.
Just nice and quiet.
For two big reasons. One, it has a door on it that closes. So this is our desk. This is our brewer's office, which is hidden behind barrels, which is great. This is our wild barrel room. So this is where we'll kind of quarantine all of our wild stuff. We've done everything from throwing previously kettle soured beers into barrels of Brett to just barrel bases, so a nice like mixed culture base that we just put in a barrel. But at this point, I'd say 9/10 of the stuff in here is 100% spontaneous from our cool ship, which is the really cool part of this room aside from the door. So this
look at that. This is our Kolsch.
Which Kolsch's are becoming more and more popular. But obviously, centuries ago, there was no Freon and glycol and Frigidaire. So when you wanted to cool down that wort as quickly as possible, your best tool was surface area. So long, shallow pan that you can knock that wort out into. When they would do it, obviously there's tons of microflora floating in the air around us. But these breweries also were wooden in a lot of places, and bacteria, yeast love chewing on wood sugars over time. So there's always stuff living in the wood. So we put some Virginia cedar in the top of our Kolsch because as the boiling wort comes into the Kolsch, it'll steam up. That steam will condensate in that wood, mix with those cultures, drop back down. So you've got 2 points basically of spontaneous inoculation coming both from the microflora living in the wood, the microflora floating outside. We've got these window baffles so that we can allow the steam to fly out. It's really, you need to be here next time because it's so awesome. It'll especially with the windows we've got here, it's like you're sitting in the middle of a rainstorm because you get this like thermodynamic draw and then, you know, gulp, and you'll get the steam like slap against the window and clouds rolling by. It's pretty fun. So we only do it after first frost because coincidentally, typically the stuff that's floating around outside that can last past the first frost but before everything gets really, really frozen is the most aesthetically and sensory pleasing. So,
wow. Yeah, I think,
and the wort will actually cool down and not just sit at 95 degrees. Like
if we want
summer.
It to ferment around 70 and it's 95 degrees outside, it's never going to get there. So,
well,
first one, November 19th, 2014. All the way up to this past, I think we got some in March this year. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, I think, Mike, I think you called this the Disney World of beer. Or who said that?
Disneyland or Disney World of brew pubs. I mean, it really is a little bit of everything, and it's a great place to have in D.C. It's always fun to have a place that really puts beer first, that it's not... And honestly, I'm glad to see that brew pubs are no longer what people thought of as brew pubs when I started drinking 10 years ago. You know, the sort of, yeah, the four core beers, a seasonal, a hamburger, and that was about it. That, you know, there are now places that have great food, you know, locally sourced ingredients, and as Josh was saying, you know, some places that have one particular thing that they take and they run with and they are the world specialist on. And other places that have the resources behind them to have a little bit of everything and to be able to do it the right way. I think a lot of places try too many things and don't have the resources to do it, or, you know, the yeast has to sit around for 2 months before the next batch of whatever comes up. And here you guys have enough fermenters. You don't have to rush things through. You don't have to deal with a lot of those constraints that breweries have.
Well, this has been amazing, and I can't wait. I've only had one beer. And I'm hungry. So, Josh, this has been a wild little ride, and very impressive. And congratulations.
Thanks. It's a pleasure. Thanks for coming out.
Thanks, Mike, for taking us around.
Of course. This is stop two on our 4-stop tour. So, don't have too much beer, James.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, James.
Well, thanks again to Josh and to the Basic Brewing crew: Andy Sparks, Steve Wilkes, Bob Stemsky, and mad fermentationist Mike Tonsmeyer, who led us on an incredible beer journey that one fine Wednesday. You can find Mike's blog at madfermentationist.com, and be sure to look for his book, American Sour Beers, if you don't have it already. Most of you probably do. It's a great read. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo. You can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can find our logbook so you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support there. Featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Ball Wide Mouth Lids and Bands 12-pack. meantime, time for some canning. And Mountain House, just in case, breakfast bucket.
I love the lot. Don't skip on the pate.
Sure, the breakfast bucket's delicious. Thanks again, everybody. And remember,
I can't tell who bought what, so no worries.
Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We
appreciate your support.
Don't forget you. Okay, I'm no more Mr. Creaso. And don't forget you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.